You're listening to Crossing the Line, a weekly podcast dedicated to giving voice to the voiceless in occupied Palestine. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Coming up on Crossing the Line, the UN General Assembly is scheduled to take up the Goldstone Report, which accuses Israel and Hamas of war crimes as a result of the Israeli offensive that took place last winter. Both sides have condemned the findings. Meanwhile, the U.S. House of Representatives is set to overwhelmingly approve a resolution condemning the Goldstone Report as biased against the State of Israel. With the backing of the U.S. Congress and the likelihood of permanent members of the Security Council vetoing the report, what's the next step in holding the parties accountable? Kathleen and Bill Christensen, formerly of the CIA, will join us to talk about it. All that and more coming up. But first, the news from Palestine.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for October 24th to October 30th, 2009. As U.S. Peace Envoy George Mitchell arrived to the region, a Palestinian fighter was reported dead this week in Gaza, while settler attacks left 14 Palestinians injured in the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report with the nonviolent activities in the West Bank with IMEMC's Iyad Khair.
Two people were injured and dozens more suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation on Friday as Israeli soldiers attacked the weekly nonviolent protest against the wall in the village of Bilayin in the central West Bank. As is the case every Friday for 4 years, villagers along with their Israeli and international supporters marched from the village after the midday prayers. As soon as the villagers arrived at the gate of the wall separating the villagers from their land, Israeli troops stationed there fired tear gas. This week, protesters demanded the release of Adib Abu Rahme, a villagers' protest organizer. Abu Rahme was kidnapped by the Israeli military 4 months ago. The military accused him of inciting violence. Protesters marched on Friday wearing masks of Adib, declaring, "We are all Adib Abu Rahme." Also on Friday in central West Bank, dozens suffered effects of tear gas inhalation by the Israeli military's fire at the weekly protest against the wall in the village of Na'lin. Villagers, along with their international Israeli supporters, held the midday prayers at their land where Israel is building the wall. Israeli soldiers fired rubber-coated steel bullets at them, along with tear gas. Dozens were also treated from the effects of tear gas inhalation. From IMEMC.org, this is Iyad Khair.
U.S. Peace Envoy George Mitchell is in the region to prepare for an upcoming visit by U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Meanwhile, controversy over elections have begun after Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas called this month for elections by January 2010. IMEMC's Jessica Halsey has the story.
U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is set to visit with Israeli and Palestinian officials next week in an attempt to push forward the stalled peace process. Palestinians and Israeli negotiators have so far failed to resume talks, despite repeated calls by the American administration to do so. Israel is keeping up with its settlement activity on occupied Palestinian land, in spite of warnings by Washington against such activities as hampering peace and the reality of a two-state solution envisioned by Washington several years ago. This week, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas called on Israel to seize what he considered a 3-week opportunity to resume peace talks, expecting the region to enter one more cycle of violence. Abbas was referring to recent clashes in the Al-Aqsa Mosque of Jerusalem, where Israeli troops protected entry of right-wing Jews into the mosque compound. He held the Israeli Prime Minister responsible for the latest violence and casting doubt over the Israeli government's intentions towards a peaceful settlement with the Palestinians. Office of the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu refuted Abbas's doubts, maintaining that Israel is still committed to non-conditional resumption of peace talks. Settlement activities are considered illegal, according to the international law and the U.S.-backed roadmap of 2003, which demands Palestinians to dismantle resistance groups, in return that Israel will halt all settlement activity on occupied Palestinian territory. Top Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat was quoted as saying that talks between the two sides cannot resume before Israel stops all form of settlement activity. Also this week, the rival Hamas and Fatah parties reached a deadlock in terms of their Egyptian-mediated talks after Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas of Fatah set January 24, 2010 as the day of general elections. Abbas's decree came right after Hamas refused to sign an Egyptian-made paper for reconciliation. Abbas argued that Hamas has no justification to decline signing the paper after Fatah had already signed. In Gaza, the ruling Hamas party warned the residents of Gaza against voting in any elections called on by Abbas. Hamas argues that the elections cannot be held before a unity deal is reached, saying that Abbas is not authorized to give such dates according to the Palestinian law. Some local media sources suggested this week that Egyptian mediators might transfer the file of inter-Palestinian talks to the Arab States League for consideration and follow-up. Other media outlets reported that a high-ranking Hamas delegation is set to visit Cairo soon upon Egyptian invitation. For IMEMC.org, this is Jessica Halsey.
A Palestinian fighter was reported dead this week as Israeli tanks continue to attack the border areas of the Gaza Strip. From Gaza, IMEMC's Ramil Mighari reports.
The Al-Qassam Brigade, the armed wing of Hamas, said that one of its fighters died on Thursday during a special mission at the southern borders with Egypt. The brigade identified the fighter as Sulaiman Abul Naja, 26 years old. They added that he was killed inside a tunnel at the borders with Egypt and gave no further details. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza announced that with the Abul Naja's death, the number of Palestinians killed inside the tunnels since 2 years has reached 130. Israel placed the Gaza Strip under siege in June 2007, leaving the 1.5 million Palestinians living there lacking all basic supplies. The tunnels are used by the local community as a way to get much-needed supplies into the Gaza Strip. In other news, the Egyptian authorities allowed a number of Palestinian patients to cross back into the Gaza Strip on Wednesday. They had been in Egypt for medical treatment. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza said that 7 of the patients were taken to the border by ambulance, while the rest were able to cross on foot. At least 361 patients have died since the Israeli siege on Gaza Strip began in June 2007. Israeli tanks raided the Palestinian side of the Karni crossing, closing it down on Monday midday. Local sources reported that tanks invaded a crossing, that the troops detained the truck drivers who were at the location, but later released them after confiscating their identity cards. Karni crossing is located on the eastern Gaza border with Israel and is the only crossing through which the Israeli military allows limited amounts of food supplies to enter Gaza. For IMEMC.org, this is Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
This week, the Israeli military conducted at least 25 military invasions into Palestinian communities in the West Bank. Troops kidnapped at least 47 Palestinian civilians, including 17 children. IMEMC's Catherine Orwell reports.
This week's invasions were focused on the cities of Jenin and Nablus in the northern West Bank, in addition to Hebron in the south. Medical sources in Jerusalem reported on Wednesday morning that a 21-year-old Palestinian from East Jerusalem was killed when his vehicle flipped over during a high-speed chase. He died instantly. The Israeli police said that the accident took place near Tel Aviv and added that police were chasing him as they suspected that the vehicle he was driving was stolen. Also on Wednesday in Jerusalem, Israeli police officers dismantled a protest tent erected by a Palestinian family near the Old City. The Al-Rawi family was camping in front of their former home in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Their home was taken over by Israeli settlers 2 months ago. Sheikh Jarrah is a Palestinian neighborhood consisting of 30 homes, all of which are threatened to be evicted by the Israeli authorities. The Israeli municipality of Jerusalem demolished on Tuesday 9 Palestinian-owned apartments. The Israeli municipality says those homes are built without the needed licenses. All the homes were located in Palestinian neighborhoods around Jerusalem's Old City. Nimr Ali, the owner of a house that was demolished, spoke to IMEMC.
I built my house 15 years ago, and I have been fighting in court since 10 years. Next week, we were to have a meeting with the municipality committee to approve our house. Today at 5 a.m., troops came, forced me and my family out. We were only able to take what we had been wearing at the time. They gave me no warning.
Tension is high in Jerusalem. On Sunday, clashes between police and residents left 35 Palestinians injured. The clashes erupted after radical Jewish groups tried to storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the second holiest site for Muslims worldwide. Ziad Al-Hamouri, head of the Jerusalem Center for Economic and Social Rights, says the escalated events in the city are part of a larger plan.
I built my house 15 years ago, and I have been fighting in court since 10 years. Next week, we were to have a meeting with the municipality committee to approve our house. Today at 5 a.m., troops came, forced me and my family out. We were only able to take what we had been wearing at the time. They gave me no warning.
All those attacks together have one aim. It's to force the Palestinians to leave Jerusalem and bring settlers instead of them.
Since Israel occupied the city of Jerusalem in 1967, it has rarely given the Palestinian inhabitants of Jerusalem permissions to build homes. Meanwhile, Israel continues to construct Jewish settlements in and around the city, an act which is illegal according to international law. Elsewhere, 8 Palestinian farmers were reported injured on Tuesday as settlers attacked them while working on their land near Nablus City in the northern West Bank. Later in the week, settlers attacked and injured 5 farmers and a journalist near Hebron City in the southern West Bank. Settler attacks targeting Palestinian farmers have escalated in the past few weeks with the start of the olive harvest season, which is considered to be the main income for farmers. For IMEMC.org, this is Catherine Orwell.
And that's just some of the news this week in Palestine. For regular updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Thank you for joining us from Occupy Bethlehem. This week's report has been brought to you by Ghassan Barnoura.
In Berkeley, I'm Najee Ali, and you're listening to Crossing the Line. On November 4th, the General Assembly of the United Nations will turn its attention to the Goldstone Report, which documents the Israeli Army offensive, codenamed Cast Lead. The offensive lasted for 22 days, destroyed the Strip's infrastructure, and left more than 1,400 Palestinians dead, a high number of whom were women and children. 13 Israelis also died during the conflict, 9 of whom were killed by mortar fire, and 4 who were Israeli soldiers by fratricide. The report accuses both the Israeli army and the Hamas government of war crimes. Israel has branded the report as biased and one-sided. The United States, Israel's strongest ally, has also said that the report was slanted against the Israeli state. Meanwhile, in U.S. House of Representatives, House Resolution 867, which is in opposition to the Goldstone Report, came up for a vote on November 3rd. The resolution essentially states that the Goldstone Report is, quote, irredeemably biased and unworthy of further consideration or legitimacy, close quote. This report and the resolution condemning it comes in the midst of President Barack Obama trying to get the Middle East peace process back on track. Obama has continually asked Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to halt all settlement activity, only to see more settlement expansion be approved for what the Israeli government claims is natural growth. So where does this leave the 1.5 million inmates of the world's largest open-air prison and their fellow citizens who have once again had their voices silenced by Israel and the U.S.? Join us to talk more about the Goldstone Report and the possible implications of it are Crossing the Line's good friends Kathleen and Bill Christensen. Kathleen Christensen is a former CIA political analyst and has worked on Middle East issues for 35 years. She is the author of Perceptions of Palestine and The Wound of Dispossession. Bill Christensen was a senior official of the CIA. He served as a national intelligence officer and as the director of CIA's Office of Regional and Political Analysis, and he had both co-authored a new book entitled Palestine in Pieces, Graphic Perspectives on the Israeli Occupation, which is available from Pluto Press. Kathleen and Bill Christensen, welcome back to Crossing the Line.
Thank you, Naji. It's good to be here.
Thanks a lot.
It's a pleasure to have you both back on the show. Kathleen, let's begin with you. Yesterday, we had a vote in the House of Representatives on Resolution 867, which I mentioned in my introduction, which is in opposition to this Goldstone report. And I want to read that quote that I had in the introduction, which states that the report is, quote, irredeemably biased and unworthy of further consideration or legitimacy, close quote. Are you at all surprised by this House resolution?
Unfortunately, no. I think the vote was 344 for it and to 22, something like 22 against and maybe 36 voting present, which is, the usual lopsided margin in these House and Senate resolutions, which are non-binding, but they do express the sense of the whatever House is issuing them. I suppose 344 is not quite as lopsided as many of these things, which get up into the high 300s or even 400s. But the in general, it is a travesty. The very idea that the Goldstone report should be condemned is appalling. And the Israel lobby has influenced Congress. They all know which side their political bread is buttered on. They know how they should vote. And unfortunately, the Obama administration has encouraged this attitude, explicitly encourage this resolution, but its own rejection of the Goldstone report certainly encouraged people to think that it was safe to vote against it.
Well, Bill, I'm a little bit confused. The UN didn't pick a far-left anti-Zionist to head the fact-finding team of this report. Richard Goldstone's a noted jurist. He's overseen atrocities in the Balkans, in Rwanda. He's very well-respected within the international criminal court community. In addition, he's a staunch Zionist, but still people have accused him of slanting this report. What opportunity is there for true democracy when so many concessions are in place that favor Israel, and yet we still hear people scream that such findings are anti-Semitic?
It shows you, I think, that the U.S. government now has a very poor democracy, and part of the responsibility for that obviously rests with all lobbies, but the one we're particularly interested in today is with the Israel lobby. Any time you have big money spent and a very powerful lobby wanting certain things done in Washington, that means that the ordinary people, the ones who should be counted as equal to anybody else in a meaningful democracy, are not being equally counted. The situation has, to some extent, always been this way in the United States over the last 150, 200 years. But the fact is, it seems to me, and I think to both of us, that this situation has simply gotten worse because of the power of the Israel lobby in recent years.
Well, what about this K Street that we've talked about on the show in the past? Okay. What have they actually said in regards to this report? Have they mentioned, have they made any kind of headway? They're presumably to the left, or at least center left, or at least center. Have they made any announcements with respect to this report or the House resolution? I'd like to hear both of your opinions. And Kathy, let's begin with you.
Okay. By the way, it's J Street, not K Street.
My apologies.
K Street is the actual street in Washington where most lobbies are headquartered. J Street is a takeoff on that because there is no actual J Street, and of course it stands for Jewish. This is a very interesting development. J Street just had its first annual, what is to be an annual conference, two or three days over last weekend. And they have apparently gotten the leadership, Jeremy Ben-Ami particularly, have gotten apparently a lot of pressure from AIPAC, the main Israel lobby organization, to the right, well to the right of J Street, have gotten such pressure that Ben Ami and the rest of the leadership of J Street are moving to the right from the center left, at least to the center. They even, he, in a recent interview with Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic, even characterized himself, or I'm not sure whether it was in that interview, but in public he has recently characterized J Street as like the Israeli Kadima Party, which is the party of Ehud Olmert, which is hardly even in the center. It certainly leans to the right. So if J Street even considers itself to be like Kadima, it is moving well to the right. And specifically on your question about the Goldstone Report, although Ben Ami and the leadership of J Street criticized Israel during Operation Cast Lead, in this interview, recent interview with Jeffrey Goldberg, Ben Ami specifically condemned the Goldstone Report, just as Congress did yesterday. So J Street is, at least the leadership, and I do want to distinguish between the leadership and the grassroots membership of J Street, or the people, the 1,500 people who attended the conference. According to everything we've read from bloggers like Philip Weiss, in particular, the leadership is moving to the right, or has moved to the right, but this grassroots membership is, many of them are questioning Zionism, questioning what Jewish identity means in political terms, and so on. So the grassroots seems, from what we've read of this conference last weekend, is pushing the leadership, trying to push the leadership back to the left.
And Bill?
You know, I want to tell you a little story. We just got back 2 weeks ago now from Palestine. It was a short, quick trip in order to hold some book signings there for our new book. But in Ramallah, we had a meeting of people and talked to maybe, I don't know, 50, 60 people. Maybe half of them were Palestinian. The other half were international workers, NGO workers, a few real diplomats in the group from various countries. And the people who were in the audience, the people who were internationals or foreign diplomats or NGO types, in other words, not Palestinians, were still very enthusiastic about Obama, everything he had done, and some of them also talked very favorably about the J Street group. The Palestinians, on the other hand, were extremely skeptical, even at that time, a couple of weeks ago, before these most recent events, were extremely skeptical of what good J Street was, and in general had really begun to lose a lot of their faith and confidence in anything Obama had to say. So I think they have looked at what Hillary Clinton did just in very recent days, and just find it impossible to have confidence in anything the United States right now is doing. Kathy, would you buy into that?
Yes, indeed. And I'd like to clarify, if I could take a minute, on what Hillary Clinton did in recent days. She was in Israel over the weekend, just coincidentally, as this J Street conference was going on. And she made a statement at a press conference with Netanyahu that sort of acknowledged that Israel was not going to freeze settlements as the U.S. has been demanding, because it's going to go ahead and U.S. nod, continue to build 3,000 housing units, which houses a lot of settlers, 15,000 new people. That with this U.S. nod, Israel is going to go ahead with that. But she said Israel is showing restraint, not a freeze. We asked them to stop settlement building, and instead they're just going to show some restraint by not doing anything beyond this 3,000. And she called this an unprecedented concession. Well, this is just outrageous. it's technically true, and she has had to backpedal a little bit as she's been traveling after this Israel visit around the Arab world, by saying the U.S. still would like a settlement freeze, but technically speaking, what Israel has done, showing any restraint, is an unprecedented concession. Well, that's absurd. As I said, she's technically correct, but Israel has never made a concession, so any concession is unprecedented, and the proof is in the pudding. When the Israelis, if they really do show some restraint, then maybe we can consider that a minor concession. But they haven't shown any restraint yet.
If I can interrupt again here, I would have to say that if there's anything to the more recent sort of semi, not even back down, but just trying to be a little more diplomatic, by Hillary Clinton, if there's anything there which indicates some sort of difference between Obama and Hillary Clinton on their individual views, it is so minor a difference as to be meaningless.
Meaningless, that's right.
Well, Kathy, I want to read a paragraph from House Resolution 867 and get your thoughts. It says, quote, "Whereas the mandate of the fact-finding mission makes no mention of the relentless rocket and mortar attacks, which numbered in the thousands and spanned a period of 8 years by Hamas and other violent militant groups in Gaza against civilian targets in Israel, that necessitated Israel's defensive measures," close quote. Kathy, what are your thoughts on this accusation?
Well, yeah, that's ridiculous. First of all, the Goldstone report did make mention of the Hamas and Palestinian rocket attacks and the damage that had been done in Israel. Secondly, the damage that has been done in Israel over the supposed 8 years that there's been relentless, quote-unquote, rocket attacks is really minimal. We were also in Palestine and Israel back in the spring, in April and May, and we drove down to Sderot. This was now, three, 4 months after Cast Lead ended, and we drove around Sderot to try to find damage. This is at a time when Gaza was still in rubble, and it still is now, even 6 months after that. There was not a sign of damage in Sderot because, first of all, the damage has always been minimal. There have been some Israelis killed, and I certainly don't mean to minimize the deaths of civilians, and I would have to say innocent civilians. But the physical damage has always been minimal, and it's quickly repaired, whereas in Gaza, where there are, according to the UN, after Operation Cast Lead, 600,000 tons of rubble that can't be cleared away because the Israelis won't even let trucks in to truck out the rubble. I mean, it's just absurd. And, of course, they won't let building materials in to Gaza to rebuild. So the disproportion between Operation Cast Lead and what it was allegedly responding to, these quote-unquote relentless rocket attacks, is just unimaginable. Also, during the 8 years when the Palestinians were supposedly conducting relentless rocket attacks, Israel was also relentlessly attacking Gaza. Operation, it was called something sweet, like Summer Rain.
Summer Rain, yes.
Yes, in the summer of 2006, June of 2006, the Israelis killed 400 Gazans, 400 mostly innocent civilian Gazans, and that was just one operation. So the Israeli atrocities against Gaza have also been far more relentless than any Gaza, any shelling from Gaza.
Well, Bill, in another section of the resolution, it states, quote, "Whereas the mission's flawed and biased mandate gave serious concern to many United Nations Human Rights Council member states, which refused to support it, including Bosnia and Herzegovina, Cameroon, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the Netherlands, the Republic of Korea, Slovakia, Slovenia, Switzerland, Ukraine, and the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland," close quote. Is it my understanding that when Goldstone first read the mission statement, he too felt it was flawed and biased and demanded that it be rewritten so as not to reflect
a predisposed outcome with regards to this is entirely Israel's fault or this is entirely Hamas's fault. I remember seeing him on Bill Moyers discussing this. Was this not true that he actually demanded that this mandate be rewritten in order that it could be more balanced?
He demanded that he be allowed to write in the report things that he felt the Palestinians had committed as criminal acts also. I don't think I was calling for a rewrite. Before he started to work, he demanded that he be allowed to talk about both sides and the allegedly evil things that both sides had done. So you're absolutely right, and he did. He has stuff in there which he himself personally demanded be included in the report so that it would be a report with better balance in it. This entire thing of what has happened to the Goldstone report in the U.S. Congress is just the best recent example you will ever see of the power of this right wing, all of the AIPAC elements of the Israel lobby in the United States, and the J Street group, and has not done much to counter that. And a great many American Jews support the Goldstone report, but the power of the lobby in the U.S. Congress and in the U.S. administration is so great that this is the kind of outcome you almost automatically expect if you know anything about that lobby and its power.
Well, speaking on that whole issue of the lobbies and of their power that they have, what chance do we have of even getting any kind of a more just and balanced way of looking at these sorts of conflicts when they arise? Earlier, Kaf, you mentioned Summer Rain, which occurred in 2006. Kaslet is now coming up on a year in less than 2 months, on December 17th is when it started, that this atrocity occurred. Yet during these times, there was a lot of outcry from people on the ground all over the world, but a lot of governments seemed to back off, with the exception of a few, which most of the superpowers label as rogue states, such as Cuba, Venezuela, Bolivia, and these sorts of places. What kind of an opportunity do we have? And I'll begin this with you, Kathy, and I'd like to get your thoughts as well, Bill. What kind of an opportunity do we have to even try to push Congress as well as other governments on these issues that Israel continually violates international law?
This is a very discouraging thing. There is some movement at the grassroots level, such as the grassroots opinions that were expressed, as I was mentioning earlier, at the J Street conference. And after so many people in the United States and around the world were so shocked at Israel's horrible atrocities during Kaslet, that there were a number of groups, mostly certainly leading elements of these groups were Jewish groups. They're right in our hometown of Santa Fe. There was one group formed, another one in Albuquerque, the large town city in New Mexico. Both largely Jewish groups that were formed to protest what Israel is doing in general, but really precipitated by Kaslet. And both of these particular groups that we know about have a mixture of real anti-Zionist Jews in them, as well as others who are soft Zionists, you might call, but critical of Israel. They're both very small. And they've unfortunately grown a little smaller and less active as the months have gone on. But there is this, at the very grassroots level, there is this growth of opinion, of anti-Israeli opinion, a critical of Israel opinion. And people, these two groups are also working, I can't say diligently, but they're at least talking about getting a BDS campaign going, that is boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel and Israeli products. So there is some movement at the grassroots level, but this continued, I don't know what you call it, stonewalling influence of the lobby, even at the J Street level, the J Street leaders, Jeremy Ben-Ami, whom I was mentioning earlier, is absolutely, in this interview that he recently conducted with the Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic, was totally opposed to any cut in military aid. Now, Israel, from the U.S., Israel is getting, as grant aid, not loans that they have to repay, $3 billion of military aid in cash every year, and they get it in cash at the beginning of each fiscal year. This is outrageous. At the leadership level of the groups like J Street, certainly AIPAC, and in Congress, there is absolutely no thought of cutting this aid. So this is very, very, very discouraging. I think Israel, for the very long range, I'm ultimately hopeful that Israel will somehow implode and collapse on itself. But that impetus, I'm afraid, is not going to come from the United States.
There is also, of course, a fair amount of opposition in Israel itself to Israeli governmental policy in cash-led and what's been happening more recently. But the fact is, it is a minority, and the United States is so supportive of Israel that there is no pressure placed on the Israeli government to make any changes. So there is no encouragement of Israelis living in Israel who themselves oppose their own government. They also hold up their hands and shrug and go along with it. This could change if there were change in the United States, but it's almost just hope on our part that we can make enough noise and criticize the policies loudly enough that Obama will change U.S. policies in this close partnership with Israel that we now are all living under. It's at the moment just hope on our part. There seems to be absolutely nothing we can do to bring about a situation where the U.S. government itself tells Israel, we're going to cut out all this military aid to you guys unless you change your policy. That just is not going to happen, and we are all of us responsible for this. We, all of us who live and vote in the United States, are responsible for this, because those of us who want change don't seem to be capable of bringing it off, and the rest of the electorate in the United States seems so apathetic that there isn't going to be sufficient pressure to bring about a change. It's a tragedy.
Well, it's interesting that you are now touching again on this issue of Obama and the demands that we need to place on his administration for change. You mentioned earlier when you and Kathy were in Palestine that you spoke with people, Palestinians in particular, who were very disillusioned by what they've recently seen with respect not only to the Goldstone Report, their more velvet glove approach towards demanding a halt to settlements. As you mentioned early, Kathy, $3 billion every fiscal year in cash, which is an outrageous amount for military aid in a region where they are the dominant superpower, obviously. Is it fair to say, even after Obama made his triumphant interview on Arab networks and his glorious speech in Cairo, that the honeymoon is officially over with the Obama administration as far as Palestinians in particular and Arabs in general in the region is concerned?
I'm afraid it is. There was never a very big honeymoon, because I think the Palestinians, in any case, were fairly skeptical from the beginning. You know, the Operation Cast Lead ended just a couple of days, 2 days, I think, before the Obama's inauguration, and Obama never, ever criticized the Israelis. In fact, he criticized Hamas, and I think the very first statement he made about it, which was a day or two after the inauguration when he appointed George Mitchell as special envoy, I forget exactly what he said, but he did, I believe, criticize Hamas and certainly did not criticize Israel for what it had just done, the horrible more than 100 to 1 kill ratio that the Israelis inflicted on the Palestinians. He never criticized that the Israel for that, and the steps he took. What he asked the Israelis for, which was a settlement freeze, was simply asking them not to keep on advancing through the occupied territories. What he was asking from the Arabs in return was normalization of diplomatic relations, or practically full normalization. And so I think it was clear to Palestinians really from the beginning that that he wasn't. He may have been serious about what he was asking the Israelis to do, but that it wasn't nearly enough. And then he got distracted, not coincidentally, I don't think, by the economic problems and the healthcare reform and all this stuff, and really ceased to pay any more attention to it. And any criticism that the U.S. has leveled against Israel has been really pretty mild. You know, Hillary Clinton gets up there and says some mild things about not even being outraged about what Israel is doing. For instance, in Jerusalem, kicking people out of their homes where they've lived for 50 plus years, homes built by the United Nations. This is in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in East Jerusalem. The most the U.S. Says about this is some mild criticism from Hillary Clinton. So I'm not sure where I'm going here, but I don't think there has been much reason to be encouraged from the beginning, and I think that's been the attitude of most Palestinians. And now they're just outraged. We were in Jerusalem when Obama was named as given the Nobel Peace Prize, and a Palestinian friend of ours, who told us his eyes were practically popping out in just utter astonishment and outrage that Obama had been given a peace prize for basically giving Israel a free pass.
And Bill, your comments?
They are no more encouraged than Kathy's in any way, shape, or manner. And when I look at all of the European countries and Japan, any other countries that are obviously have people who are interested in this problem, we are not getting the progressives in the United States who oppose present Israeli and U.S. policies everywhere in the Middle East, we are not getting meaningful support from European nations or Japan on any of this. It is simply a matter where we have got to get out there and be noisier than ever and be willing to stick our necks out far more than we have to date, and it just doesn't seem to be that there's anything but apathy on this issue here in the United States. So no, I am so discouraged. I could break a piece of wood with my fists or something.
Okay, and final question for both of you, and Kathy, we'll begin with you today. Well, we are recording this. It is November 4th. That means that the UN General Assembly is meeting at this moment, speaking about this Goldstone report. Now, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon of the UN said he wouldn't speculate on whether or not this was going to be sent to the Security Council or possibly to the International Court in The Hague, more than likely to the Security Council if that happens. what is its prognosis? Do you strongly believe that the U.S. will use its veto power to kill this report right then and there?
Yes, I would have to say that it's almost a sure thing that if it goes to the Security Council, the U.S. would veto it. And if it goes to The Hague, I'm sure that it will meet the same fate as the, when was it, 5 years ago? I'm blanking out. On the settlements. What did The Hague do 5 years ago? I'm sorry to do this on the air.
There was absolutely nothing done 5 years ago or any amount of time ago, Kathy. It is just one of these times when the United Nations, all of the less developed countries will have their vote. There may be something happen in the General Assembly, but then it has to go to the Security Council, and the U.S. isn't going to let anything happen.
Yeah, and even if Ban Ki-moon makes some mild criticisms of Israel, he has basically no power. And so the bottom line is that nothing, I'm sure, will happen. Israel is obviously worried about this Goldstone report, but so far it's hard to see any concrete reason why it should be worried.
Are they more worried that this report came out so scathing, or are they more worried that a staunch Zionist was actually one of the ones who led the way and wrote it?
Well, that probably has something to do with it. They had launched a Hasbara propaganda campaign against it even before the report came out. You know, after the Goldstone mission had been established, I'm sure they are quite chagrined that a staunch Zionist whose daughter I believe lives in Israel and who has all the good Zionist credentials, he's on the board of Hebrew University and so on. I'm sure it's quite they are quite chagrined, the Israelis, that he has criticized them or been overseen a report that so roundly criticizes them. But so far, their propaganda campaign against the report is winning. The Obama administration has criticized the report, and now the House, and it would be no surprise if the Senate came along with another similar resolution.
You know, there is some hope that the boycott, divestment, and sanction campaign, which is basically a campaign being led by Palestinians themselves against Israel, there is some meaningful hope that that will catch fire and lead to an expansion of opposition to present Israeli and U.S. policies. But, you know, it's very iffy, and I can sit here and say there is some hope of this happening, and I certainly hope it happens, but we just don't see it yet getting off the ground, as it must do and as it may do, and as Kathy and I will work our hearts out to try and make it more successful.
There has been, we shouldn't minimize the success of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign, which has had some fairly significant successes. There's a light rail system being built in Jerusalem to connect the settlements in East Jerusalem to Israel. And because of this boycott campaign, a major company has pulled out. I believe it was a French company or a Belgian.
Yeah, it is French.
And that's, you know, things like that, and there are other examples like that, are huge successes. But that the overall progress in the BDS campaign is so small compared to what is going on is that we need to encourage it, and we need to be hopeful that it will succeed have more success. But so far, the progress is minuscule.
You know, there's another angle here. All of the developments in the Middle East and Central Asia are linked to one another. There is real linkage in every single issue, the war in Afghanistan, the war in Pakistan, the potential war in Iran, and the Palestinian situation. All of these things are linked, and any sort of very large defeat, something that could be considered a large defeat of the United States, for example, in Afghanistan or the Afghanistan-Pakistan combination, a large defeat there could bring about significant changes of attitude in European countries as well as in the United States. You know, just early this morning, the BBC was clamoring about five English soldiers who had been killed in Afghanistan yesterday. Five in one day is a big punch for the British to take with the number of troops that they have in Afghanistan. Other things that could happen still in Iraq or in Iran also can go either way. They can either encourage more aggressiveness on the part of America or be really damaging to our present policies. The point I'm trying to make, and not articulately enough, is that when events occur in the other major problems affecting the Middle East and Central Asia, they can have more implications and effects on the Palestinian situation than most of us even realize, in my opinion. And that may be something to be a little bit hopeful about, because things are not going well for the United States in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Iran, and these things are tied to the Palestinian situation and the entire U.S.-Israeli partnership can be affected by such things.
And we are going to leave it there. Again, we have been speaking to Kathleen and Bill Christensen. Both are formerly with the CIA. Kathleen served as a political analyst and worked on Middle East issues for 35 years. She is the author of Perceptions of Palestine and the Wound of Dispossession. Bill Christensen was a senior official of the CIA, served as national intelligence officer, and as director of the CIA's Office of Regional and Political Analysis. And they have co-authored a new book entitled Palestine and Pieces, Graphic Perspectives on the Israeli Occupation. I would encourage all of our listeners to go out and get this book, which is available from Pluto Press. Kathleen and Bill Christensen, as always, it's a pleasure, and thank you for joining us again on Crossing the Line.
Thank you, Nazi, very much.
Thanks for having us.
You have been listening to Crossing the Line, which is produced by members of the Podcast Collective in Berkeley, California. Special thanks to news producer George Lushmawi, segment producer Ali Budner, contributing producers Mumia Abu-Jamal, Rami Almagari, Scott Berguin, Quiva Butterly, and Nora Barrows-Friedman. From all of us here, we thank you so much for your continued support. In Berkeley, this is Naji Ali for Crossing the Line. Signing off.